You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of April, 2013, right here on Monocle 24. Good morning and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Tyler Brûlé, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, ABC News' man here in London, Jeffrey Kaufman, joins us to set the day's agenda.
And after the new governor of the Bank of Japan announces a spending spree, we hear from Tokyo for the response to the latest example of Abenomics.
Haruhiko Kuroda was brought in to do exactly what he's now doing, which is to implement a very aggressive policy of monetary easing, which his predecessor said he just wasn't really prepared to do and didn't think it would make any difference. So it's a really radical departure from the old policy.
And our design editor, Hugo McDonald, will walk us through what to expect from the special Monocle 24 broadcast from the next week's 52nd annual Salone di Mobile in Milan.
Plus, we satisfy our sweet tooth with a taste of Istanbul's culinary treasure.
Pomegranate and pistachio, that one. I love that. That's my best. Look at me.
All that, plus we play some music as well, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
Good morning from Studio One here at Midori House. In London, I'm very happy to say that this is the world premiere of the Tyler Brûlé and Phil Hahn Canadian duo show this morning.
I'm very excited.
Yes, yeah, so, and it's going to get more Canadian. The only person who's taking it out of the balance for now, of course, is Barney Burton with headlines. In a moment, we'll be joined by ABC News' Jeffrey Kaufman. First World Headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The United Nations Secretary General says the current crisis over North Korea has gone too far. On Wednesday, Pyongyang's official news agency said the army had been given final permission to launch nuclear strikes on America. The US has since announced that it's sending an advanced missile defense system to the Pacific island of Guam. Speaking on a visit to Spain, Ban Ki-moon warned that any misjudgment could have grave consequences.
Nuclear threat is not the game is very serious. I think they have gone too far in their rhetorics. And I'm concerned that if by any misjudgment, by any miscalculations of the situation, if any unwanted a crisis happens on the Korean Peninsula, this will have very serious implications.
The United Nations Security Council has condemned in the strongest terms Wednesday's Taliban suicide bomb attack in western Afghanistan. 9 Taliban suicide bombers killed themselves and 44 other people in an attack on a courtroom where 10 of their comrades were on trial. It was the biggest death toll in a single attack since 2011. Rwanda's UN ambassador, Eugene Richard Gasana, is this month's Security Council president.
The members of the Security Council reiterated their serious concern at the threats posed by the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and illegal armed groups to the local population, national security forces, international military, and international assistance efforts in Afghanistan. The members of the Security Council reaffirmed that terrorism in all its forms and manifestations is criminal and unjustifiable.
At least 28 people have been killed and many more are missing after a building which was still under construction collapsed on the outskirts of Mumbai. It's feared that many people are trapped in the ruins of the 7-storey building. Police say it was being constructed illegally and 4 floors were already occupied. At least 9 children are reported to be among the dead and at least 54 people have been injured. Authorities in China have begun culling birds at a poultry market in Shanghai, where 4 people have died of a new strain of bird flu. The Huihui market for live birds in Shanghai has been shut down and birds are being culled after authorities detected the H7N9 virus in samples of pigeons in the market. There have been 14 confirmed cases of the strain, all of them in eastern China. 6 people have died. The British budget airline EasyJet says strong demand over Easter has helped cut their predicted first-half loss. It now expects a pre-tax loss for the 6 months to the end of March, a traditionally loss-making period of between £60 and £65 million. Its previous guidance was for losses of between 50 and 75 million. Over the same period a year ago, it made a pre-tax loss of £112 million. The company said revenue per seat grew by about 8.5%, better than the 6-8% it previously expected, driven by strong bookings in the run-up to Easter. On its first day, the Women of the World Summit in New York has honoured Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani teenager shot in the head by the Taliban last year for advocating girls' education. 15-year-old Malala has become an international figure as a symbol of resistance to Taliban efforts to deny women's rights. She's even among the nominees for this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Following the attack, Vital Voices, with a donation from the Women in the World Foundation, established the Malala Fund. It'll be directed by Malala, and she says she'll use it to help with the education of girls in Pakistan. The actress Angelina Jolie paid tribute to her courage.
In a brutal attempt to silence her voice, it grew louder, and she more resolute, calling on the entire world, not just Pakistan, to ensure the right for every girl and boy to an education. It is my right, she said. It is our right.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney, for those news headlines. We'll see you back in about 24 minutes with another check of the world news. It is 8:06 here in London. Hello, Tyler.
Hello again,
Phil. It is
Phil.
The world premiere of the Tyler and Phil show.
And Phil show. Yeah. I'm looking at the Chosun Ilbo. This is the morning edition. Well, actually now late afternoon in Seoul. And quite a remarkable story that they're leading on right now. The headline is Hackers Bust North Korean Propaganda Site. We have a picture now that they've posted this on the Arumin Zokri site. This is, as it says here, it really disseminates as in newsletter form to the 9,001 subscribers to the KCNA news agency's, obviously, newsletters that they send out throughout the day. We have an image of Kim Jong-un. He's got evil elf ears. He has a turned-up piggy nose, very saggy boobies, and an open top. He's got Mickey Mouse tattooed on the front. He's holding a rake, and it says, and this is the image, I guess, if you went to their site right now as they've hacked it, it says wanted Kim Jong-un, also known as Nuke Nuke Mickey Lover, and then it lists all of the crimes. Not a very big reward they're looking for, though. It's only $1 million.
That's not very much. No. A world dictator, one of the most evil men on the planet.
And anyway, this is what they're leading with now. I guess after we come back from the break, we'll be talking to Jeffrey Kaufman, though. Looks like we're also going to be leading with Korea. Back in a moment.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London,
desde Londres,
Holanda,
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're indeed listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, this is the first week of our new radio agenda, new shows at new times covering the international stories in our very Monocle way. One new addition to the premiere this week is the Agenda Setter, where we quite simply kickstart the day by running through some of the stories that will feature on our radar across the news agenda, hopefully the next for 24 hours or so.
And joining us here in the studio is Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News. And he's been having a trawl through today's international newspapers in the early hours of this morning. You've chosen some stories for us here, Jeffrey, but of course everyone's still talking about Korea, aren't they?
You know, this new segment called The Agenda, really it should be called The Crystal Ball. It's predicting. I would like to tell you what celebrities will die in the next 24 hours. But yes, Korea is the big international story. Tyler has already trumped me a little bit with his comments about, Mickey?
Nuke Nuke Mickey Lover.
Nuke Nuke Mickey Lover, Kim Jong-un.
There's got to be a song in there somewhere.
You know, I love the word bellicose, and it really does fit into to this story. I mean, this is just a lot of bravado from a menacing guy who has too much power in his hands. He doesn't have as much power, Kim Jong-un, as he claims. He never has. And remember, most of those missiles that they shoot up never quite get anywhere. They just fizzle down. But we're talking about nukes. And the world would be obviously remiss if it didn't respond. And so the U.S. is responding. And that's what we'll be looking at. We have been looking all week, but it is accelerating as the U.S. moves ground-based defenses missiles to Guam, which is just over 3,000 kilometers from the North Korean peninsula, but it's close enough, they think, to stop any threat to the continental U.S. Should any of Kim Jong-un's missiles actually work. There's no belief that they do. But, you know, as I say, this is nuke. It's an exasperating world issue when you have so many problems in North Korea, such extreme poverty, such oppression. And here is this man, now the third generation of maniacs, running that country.
Yeah.
But do you really, sorry, Tyler, do you really think it is all bravado? We've never seen moves like this from the North in a very long time. They've never closed that industrial complex since it was first opened in 2000. They are moving missiles to the east coast of North Korea. It must be more than just bravado, though.
You know, you can't. We don't know. It is one of the last closed countries on the planet. What we know is limited. But we do know that the bravado I'm talking about is really the extent of their missiles. I mean, he's quoted as saying that he will launch merciless military strikes on the U.S. Or his military leaders are saying that. There's no evidence that they could actually reach the U.S. It's a very long way. So I think that is seen as bravado. The fact that they have nuclear weapons is not. We know they do. So, yeah, the question is just how they can punch, but how far? The problem, of course, is you don't want to be caught off guard. And so U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel is deploying they're called THAAD. Missile interceptor batteries to Guam. Who knows? But yeah, there's a mixture here of legitimate threat and a lot of boasting.
Jeffrey, do you think also, not just commentators, but whether it's the State Department, the Pentagon, all parties that have to be involved and you know, could be on the front line of all this, are slightly on the back foot because so often we hear that this is, it's bellicose, you know, as you led with, and this is, it's a lot of theatrics, it's about getting people around the table. But I think this is really the first time I've heard people sort of measuring their tone a little bit more, saying it's actually moving at such a speed.
Right.
I mean, the fact that, of course, you know, here we see this, this manufacturing facility, they've really circled the wagons around it. The South Koreans are in there, can't get out, etc. If you were sitting in Pacific Command in Honolulu right now, as you said, we see all of these ships being deployed to the region. Do you think, I mean, really, this time the U.S. feels that they really have to act?
Clearly. I mean, this is a rogue state, and you can't, at this point, things are being amped up so high, you cannot ignore it. The U.S. has to have its defenses ready. And the U.S., let's face it, can demolish what they've got there, but doesn't want to get into an engagement of that nature. But it's a defensive footing with a preparation for offense. This is a threat, but... My crystal ball isn't telling me what we'll be talking about when we sit here 5 days from now. So you have to be prepared. I don't think we know. Mm-hmm. And so based on that, the world has to respond effectively. It is very worrisome, and it is not the direction you want these kind of geopolitical situations to go in.
I mean, one thing we do know is that it doesn't look like the weather is going to change anytime soon.
Well,
here you have it typed out on our briefing sheet, you know, in big bold caps, weather.
Right. Well, let's go from the insidious to the inconvenient. And just for the record, you know, those of us sitting here in the UK are still enduring freezing winter temperatures, and if it's any comfort to those of us in Europe, because it's really like this across Northern Europe, it's not any better in North America, where there was 6 inches of snow in Virginia overnight, and people are asking around the world, when will it stop? I mean, we're in April.
So look into your crystal ball. When is it going to stop?
By September. This really is. People are talking about this because people are so fed up with this winter that just isn't ending. And, you know, people say, well, gee, I guess it's not global warming. But let me correct. The real term is climate change and extreme swings of weather. The term global warming, I think, has confused people. And so, you know, this conversation that you hear inanely about, oh, my God, there's no global warming because look at what's happening, you know, across the northern half of the planet. It's these extreme swings, and that may well explain some of this.
And moving on to another topic here, 787, Boeing's Dreamliner.
I had to put this in for Tyler.
I mean, this is a story that at least plays out about five times a day on this.
Does it really? Does it come up a lot, Tyler?
It does a lot because on one side, it is such a major story. I think what's interesting about it as well is Boeing's actually getting, I think, quite an easy ride out of all of this. The real catastrophe that could have happened was, oh, you know, there's a small sort of, you know, battery fire was bubbling away. It was very fortunate that aircraft was over land because you don't have much time. And I think we saw what happened.
Have you been on one?
Yes, I have been on one.
And are they as spectacular as?
No, it's a tarted up 767. I think that's, you know, when people do get to fly on this aircraft, it's not that exciting. What's different, of course, is the technology. It's lighter. But one of the things I don't like about the plane is that it creaks when you fly because it's carbon fiber. So if you think of sort of skis and other things, I mean, I guess it does bend, but it doesn't make a very nice noise.
It's a lot quieter too, isn't it? The cabin.
It is quiet,
apart from the freaks.
Well, yeah, but also I'm not a fan of quiet cabins because if you fly in the A380 as well, you can hear every bodily function 30 rows back, and that ain't great.
But what's interesting about this, for the reason it's on today, is that they may well have their final test flight today to get approvals, and all of those 787s could be back in the air by next month, by May. It's interesting also that Boeing is doing extremely well. $15 billion sale of 737s to everyone's favorite British airline, Ryanair. a staggering number of airplanes to the world's cheapest discount, miserable discount airline.
The interesting fact as well that also British Airways, huge vote of confidence for them, have also gone and confirmed their orders for 787s. There are options, and they've now said they're going ahead, or at least the parent company, IAG, has said they're going ahead with the purchase of 18 aircraft.
Exactly, and that really says that the 787, that people have confidence that this is a glitch. This is new technology, creaking aside. This is the direction of the 21st century airline, and it's clear that you're right. Boeing is being given a certain amount of leeway. This is they're flying something that is really revolutionary in the industry, and people want to see it succeed, and they have confidence that Boeing can solve this. I should say also that the latest reports I'm reading are that there wasn't actually a fire; it was smoke, Boeing feels that is arguing that this was overplayed, but they're taking it seriously, and they have now what they say is a 3-day fix that can make this safe for each of the planes.
I don't want smoke in my plane. Semantics.
I think you're right about that.
Jeffrey Kaufman from ABC, their man in London, our man in the studio this morning. Thanks, guys.
Coming up, a new man at the top of Japan's central bank, a new economic stance. We see how the markets are reacting to Japan's new war on deflation.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
From Monaco.
From Monaco.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monaco.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monaco. I'm Sheena Rossiter.
From Monaco. In Hong Kong. I'm Liv Levitchner.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House. It is a 4:19 in Tokyo, 8:19 here in London. After decades of deflation and falling prices, sluggish growth and or recession, no one denies Japan's economy was in need of a change. The so-called Abenomics, Shinzo Abe's big government spending drive, and the extensive asset buying program announced yesterday by his new central bank governor, Haruhiko Kuroda, is now underway.
And the Bank of Japan's announced spending spree yesterday saw the yen plummet in value and bolstered hopes that the poor export economy and the days of constantly falling prices may be ending. In a moment, we'll hear how the markets have been performing. But of course, now we should probably cross over to our bureau to speak to our bureau chief there, Fiona Wilson. Hello, Fiona.
Hello there.
Tell me, I mean, it's really something, and we've spent many years now talking about the very sad state of the PR machine surrounding the Japanese government, and just how it this revolving door of leadership has not been able to get it right. You know, yesterday I was speaking to several colleagues here and just saying just the remarkable transformation of just under this new leadership. Certainly all of the fan that surrounded Mr. Kuroda. What do you attribute to this to? Do you think that there's suddenly an amazing new spin doctor in there as well? Because it also seems that the world's media isn't quite as down on Japan as they've been over the last decade.
No, you're right. They're not as hard as they have been. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, in some ways, it's all new and energetic. But, you know, we've seen Shinzo Abe before. And I think, you know, part of the thing for him is he had one, you know, crack at being prime minister, didn't do very well. And he's come back really energized for now anyway. And he's come out very aggressively on the economy. I think he wants people to focus on that and not on the Senkaku or all these other complicated geopolitical issues that are troubling Japan at the moment. It's all about the economy. It's all about the domestic audience. And, you know, he put Haruhiko Kuroda into the Bank of Japan. Now, of course, he didn't personally put him in, but that's the man he wanted. And he's got Kuroda doing exactly what he hoped he would do, which is he's going to spend a lot of money and end deflation. Now, whether that makes people in Japan satisfied as it remains to be seen, because at the moment it's just all talk. It doesn't actually, so far it hasn't made any difference. It's just about expectation and the sort of mood, I think.
And Fiona, monetary policy, quantitative easing, not necessarily the sexiest topics to talk about, but as Tyler mentioned, the PR machine's really got everyone outside of Japan at least talking about it. What's the mood there in Tokyo? Is it a hot topic of conversation?
I mean, you know, I wouldn't say it's a hot topic. I mean, quantitative easing is never a hot topic, really, is it? But I mean, of course, you know, my first reaction is if the market is delighted, that makes me a little bit worried for the consumer, because, you know, generally I feel that people in Japan have got used to deflation. In fact, they quite like having 100 yen shops. They like Uniqlo. They like these very cheap lunch sets. In a way, people have adapted to the situation in Japan. And it may not be popular to say this, but in some ways, deflation has served Japan rather well. It has low unemployment, huge infrastructure investment. You know, if you come to Japan, this is not a country teetering on the brink of disaster. And, you know, you arrive at the airport, it all looks in very good shape. And that couldn't be said for a lot of other countries which have been very critical of Japan's monetary policy. So I think for a lot of people on the street, it's not quite clear exactly how this will be good for them. What they're hearing is, well, so far, the yen is weakening, which is not so great if you're going abroad, and that prices look like they will rise. And of course, the concern is that prices might rise, but wages don't catch up with them. And then you've got a bit of a gap. And what will that lead to? So it's very unclear at the moment. I know certainly the markets seem to be happy, though.
If, you know, with the gently falling yen, one of the remarkable things we've seen really over the last year has been this global buying spree that corporate Japan has been on. And you only have to look even over the last few weeks. Probably these were deals which were, you know, too late to get out of the, you know, the terms were already fixed. So it's probably not going to hurt any Japanese companies. But amazing what, you know, I was even looking on the Nikkei yesterday, quite a significant German chemical company being snatched up, you know, by one arm of Mitsubishi, etc. Do you think that that continues, that there's, because clearly, you know, Abe, you know, is going to want a very, you know, fulsome and still aggressive, you know, Japan Incorporated, is he not?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think for Japan, anyone with a sort of aggressive entrepreneurial stance, it's the only way forward. I mean, you just have to look at the demographics. Japan is not getting any bigger. The working population is not going to be getting any larger. Now, for companies to do better in the future, they have to start looking abroad. They have to look to new markets. They can't just depend on the domestic market, which has been enormous and has done incredibly well for Japan up till now. But looking ahead, these big companies have to be more ambitious and they have to look abroad. So regardless of the value of the yen, they still have to think about buying outside Japan.
Fiona, I look forward to seeing you, I guess, in about a week. Tell me, that is Sakura season still in full swing?
You know, it's just coming to an end, and I felt rather guilty when you were just talking about the weather in London, because it's absolutely stunning here. We've got the windows wide open.
Well, I've heard there's been torrential rain, though, hasn't there? I heard like 2 days of biblical rain, so...
Yes, that's right. It's classic spring weather, up and down.
Okay, well, hold on to the Sakura till then. We're going to stay in Tokyo, though, for a moment and talk to Jesper Cole, senior analyst at JP Morgan in Tokyo. Hello, Jesper.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm excellent.
That's good. Well, I get, clearly Friday afternoon is kicking into gear in Tokyo. Tell me, how have the markets behaved today? It's been amazing, as we were saying a little bit earlier, just watching the Abe show. And what are the markets saying in Tokyo now?
Look, I mean, you know, we are having a massive bull market here, and the investment community is learning what Abe means, A-B-E. Asset bubble economy. You've seen, you know, a stunning rally in the stock market, and very interestingly, you know, you can now borrow money for 10 years fixed at below 0.5%, which is the lowest it has ever been in history.
And yes, but we're saying, you know, the yen already is at very low levels, and these moves by the Bank of Japan could see the yen fall even further. Obviously, that's great news for Japanese companies, Japanese exporters. Is there a concern in Japan and also in the region that countries outside of Japan are starting to get a bit frustrated that their yen is so low? I know that there have been some critics, at least in the U.S., saying they're even mulling the word currency. You know, they're fixing their currency.
Look, I mean, you know, there's obviously, you know, for the last 20 years, the yen has been strengthening. And thank you, that served the Koreans, the Chinese, and everybody else rather well. Now it goes the other way around. But remember what's the driver, you know, behind Abenomics. It is the fact that Japan now has a national project. Abe wants to strengthen the economy because of one thing primarily, which is they do want to stand up to the People's Republic of China. I think that the geopolitical issue that started last summer, you know, the strife over the Senkaku Islands, that territorial conflict or the threat of a territorial conflict really focused the minds of the Japanese elite. They know that they do need to have a strong economy if they want to have a seat at the table to discuss national security.
Jesper Cole, we're going to let you get on with your weekend in Tokyo. That was senior analyst for JP Morgan, Jesper Cole, talking to us. And also a little bit early, we had our bureau chief, Fiona Wilson, there.
And up next, Monocle's design editor, Hugo McDonald, will join us in studio to talk all about furniture.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monaco 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monaco 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
And you are back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, next week, the city of Milan will be awash with people talking about furniture. It's the 52nd annual, say it, Phil.
Salone di Mobile.
Very good.
So that's my best Italian.
The biggest trade show devoted to the design world. Among the many thousands of designers, architects, buyers, and journalists pouring into the city, Monocle will, of course, have its own little delegation in hand.
And picking their way through the triumphs and the trash, our design editor, Hugo McDonald, plus producer Alad John, and a band of merry helpers will be hosting the briefing from Monday to Wednesday from a different venue in the city each day. Well, Hugo joins us now in the studio to give us a little preview of what to expect and what he's most excited about. Thanks very much for coming in studio, Hugo.
It's a pleasure.
So you're You're about to pack your bags and head off to Milan.
I am indeed. If I can get through the mountain of invitations and press releases that have been flooding into my inbox over the last, well, month now, it seems.
And how's it shaping up to be this next week?
Well, it's interesting, actually. This is the first year, I think, in the last seven that I can remember where, having said that there's a mountain, it does seem that it might be a quieter affair than it has been in previous years. And I think the furniture industry is obviously slower than other luxury industries to react to the recession. I think people are beginning, in the last few years, there's been a lot of posturing about the fact that, no, everything's fine, we're all okay, we haven't been affected, we've been exporting far more, we're not so reliant on the Italian markets. This seems like the first year that actually maybe things have slowed down a little bit.
What gives you that sense, though?
Apparently rent prices are much cheaper in the city for exhibitors, and people have been struggling to fill them, which, I mean, for anybody who's been to Salone in the last 3 years, they'll know that really it's been a case of just ramping up and up and up in terms of exhibitors. Like, every single spare space that can hold a chair usually does. This year, things seem to be a little bit thinner. People have consolidated, everybody's joining together and doing big group exhibitions, which for me and anybody who goes from sort of journalist or buyer point of view is great news.
Do you think there's also a bit of a, maybe a correction finally going on as well, because we've talked about it over the years that there's been so many other sideshows. It doesn't matter whether you've got a beverage or a vehicle, you know, or toilet paper to launch. So everyone wants to sort of tack themselves somehow onto what's happening in Milan. So do you think maybe part of that circus is also, it's moved to the art world or it's gone somewhere else?
Absolutely,
as well?
Absolutely, I think you're quite right. The art world has sort of not suffered, but it's reaping the rewards in many ways of what the design industry was enjoying about 5 years ago, where, like you say, all the other industries wanted a piece of design because suddenly it was what everybody was talking about. Now they've realised there isn't a huge amount of money in it, or not as much money as they hoped, and the audience maybe isn't quite as big as they hoped. Yeah, it's looking a little thin.
And as we heard, we'll be having a couple special editions of The Briefing.
Three.
Next week, from Monday to Wednesday. Tell us a bit of, give us a sneak preview of those shows.
Well, on day one, we'll be coming to you live from the Museum of Science and Technology. On day two, we're going to be from Rossana Orlandi, which is a beautiful little courtyard gallery. And then on day three, we're going to be from a big sort of pop-up shop exhibition area in the Brera district of Milan.
And who's going to be joining you? What type of voices? Aside from, of course, our own, you know, very informed editors, etc., who'll be joining you.
We've got a host of brilliant names lined up, from designers to manufacturers from all over the world. We've also got buyers. We've got some business analysts in there too. It's going to give you a complete cross-section of everything that's happening in the city and what the wider implications are for the things that are on show too.
Excellent. Hugo MacDonald, I'm going to... I'm going to see upstairs probably in a few minutes, because you can see this very, very large pile. Many, many, many design stories here, which...
Wonderful design stories.
Very, very good design stories, because you didn't plug the fact that also we've got our design issue, which is also coming out
indeed,
as well.
Indeed, 64 pages of wonderful opinion and chairs.
We will look forward to that. You are listening to Midori House. Mr. Barney Burnham is just making his way into studio. Phil, I wanted to... Have you ever done the Salone in Milan before?
As you can tell from my pronunciation, probably not.
Okay,
no,
well, this is one of the reasons why Alan John is going to produce it and not you.
But he's Welsh.
Listen. The Welsh know plenty. Lovely cottage industries down there. Mr. Barney Burnham has joined us in the studio with the bottom of our headlines.
Thanks, Tyler. The United Nations Secretary General says the current crisis over North Korea has gone too far. Ban Ki-moon has warned that any misjudgment could have grave consequences. The UN Security Council has condemned in the strongest terms Wednesday's Taliban suicide bomb attack in western Afghanistan. 9 Taliban suicide bombers killed themselves and 44 others in an attack on a courtroom where 10 of their comrades were on trial. At least 28 people have been killed and many more are missing after a building which was still under construction collapsed on the outskirts of Mumbai. It's feared that many people are still trapped in the ruins of the 7-storey building. Authorities in China have begun culling birds at a poultry market in Shanghai, where 4 people have died of a new strain of bird flu. There have been 14 confirmed cases of the strain, all of them in eastern China. 6 people have died. The British budget airline EasyJet says strong demand over Easter has helped cut their predicted first half loss. It now expects a pre-tax loss for the 6 months to the end of March, a traditionally loss-making period of between £60 and £65 million. The previous estimate was for losses of between £50 and £75 million. On its first day, the Women in the World Summit in New York has honoured Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani teenager shot in the head by the Taliban last year for advocating girls' education. Following the attack, Vital Voices, with a donation from the Women in the World Foundation, established the Malala Fund. It'll be directed by Malala, and she says she'll use it to help with the education of girls in Pakistan. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back in about 26 minutes at 9 o'clock in the morning here in London for another check of the world news. Now, you're back with Midoriya House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Tyler Brulé. And the time is 9:34 in Budapest, which is where we head now for a roundup of the headlines on the ground there.
And Adam Labor is our man in the town, on the town. He is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I was out on the town last night.
Okay, we can come back to that a little bit later, Adam. Now tell me, I want to go back at the top of the program. We were talking to ABC's Jeffrey Coffin about the state of the weather. Occasionally, Middle Europa can be a little bit toastier, at least in this side of the continent. How are the cheery Hungarians?
Well, it's pretty cold here. I mean, we're same as everywhere else in Europe, waiting for the spring. It's 4 or 5 degrees, it's grey and overcast, and we're really just counting the hours till there's a bit of sunshine.
I wanted to, where do you want to start? Do you want to keep it on a upper cultural note, or do we want to talk about some of the constitutional changes that we're looking at, and certainly some flare-ups in Parliament?
Yes, I mean, there's been a huge flare-up here, which has got a lot of international attention. It's something that it seems obscure, but it's actually very important. It's the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. Hungary has a new constitution which came into force after the government was elected in 2010. And when the constitution was passed, it was supposed to be sort of set in stone, but it's been repeatedly amended. And the most recent amendment, which has got a lot of international attention, especially in the US Senate, they were even holding, and the Congress are holding hearings about Hungary in this, is that the power to check legislation for constitutionality has been removed from the Constitutional Court, which is one thing. And the second thing is that once that's happened, the government is putting laws into the Constitution that the Constitutional Court had previously thrown out. So there's a lot of concern about that because it seems to blur the line between the government and the legislature. One of the checks and balances has gone.
And Adam, do we have a sense why Prime Minister Orbán is seizing all this power?
Well, it's a very interesting question because this year, this month actually, was the 25th anniversary of the founding of
Yeah, it seems like we've lost. Maybe it's the cold, frosty phone lines.
Or the hangover.
something like that. Something happened to Mr. Labor. I'm not quite sure where. I'm going to go for a short break. I'm going to try to see if we can recover that phone line to Budapest. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
And you are back in Midori House with Phil Hahn and Tyler Brulé. And this is Midori House, and we're going back to Budapest. Adam Labor, are you there?
I'm here. Yes.
It sounded like you actually left the phone on the counter and you went to make yourself a coffee or something.
I wouldn't do that in the middle of an interview.
Okay, good. Anyway, why don't we move on maybe from where we were a little bit earlier. We'll take it to a cultural note. There's an exhibition opening up at the Museum of Fine Arts.
Yes, there's an exhibition of Helmut Newton prints, some of his great prints from his years as a fashion photographer, some of the shots he did for Chanel and Vogue and Versace and all the major fashion houses. And that's getting quite a lot of attention. Photography is a big thing in Hungary because there was a lot of, historically, there's been some great Hungarian photographers like Kappa and Mihai Kertész and and others. So photography always gets a lot of attention out here.
And what's the general arts scene there in Hungary? Is there a push, do you think, to make it an arts hub for the region?
Well, Hungarians are very proud, and rightly proud, of their very vibrant arts and cultural life here. And I think certainly they would like to be seen as a regional hub. I mean, it's slightly hard to compete with Vienna because of the amount of museums and historical sites that there are there. But the Hungarians are definitely holding their own. And there's a very lively kind of counterculture sort of boho scene here as well, of artists and writers and musicians. So yeah, there's all sorts of aspects of that going on here, and it's extremely lively and very busy.
And just before we go, how much of the art's been impacted, just given the state of finances in Hungary? Of course, you know, Brussels can be, you know, quite generous sometimes with various handouts for cultural initiatives. But would you say, when you talk about, let's say, you know, the boho scene, or what might be, you know, being driven maybe a little bit more underground, you know, clearly that's probably not coming from funding from Budapest or from Brussels. It's probably at the hands of private investors, no?
Yes, it's more from private sponsors that are sponsoring exhibitions and galleries, less so from Brussels. I mean, the problem with the money that comes from Brussels is that it goes through the government, and in that sense, the art scene, with the money that the government has to dispense, has become politicized. A lot of people are saying in museums and other places that this general kind of government takeover of various aspects of Hungarian life is now extending into the arts, unfortunately. So if you're not on the right side of the ruling party, then your exhibition's less likely to get support than if you are. I mean, these things are very hard to prove one way or the other, because it's a question of taste, but there's definitely a sense among the artistic scene that seems to be happening.
So now, speaking of the arts, just before we go very quickly, I understand that there is a book almost done on press. Will the Adam Labor book be thumping down on desks quite shortly?
I very much hope so. The Adam Labor thriller, the Geneva option, is actually out this week in London, and it's a conspiracy thriller set in and around the United Nations. Slight Hungarian touch in there, of course, as well. And it's going to be coming out in New York, published by HarperCollins next month. So we're very excited about that.
Okay, well, we look forward. We'll talk more about that, I'm sure, on one of our culture briefings. Adam Labor in Budapest for us. Thanks very much for that.
You're listening to Midori House. Up next, the hidden treats of Istanbul. We get a taste of a sneak preview from this week's edition of The Menu and take a bite of some Turkish delights.
Berlin has long been a magnet for artists. As the city continues to evolve, Monocle Films explores how galleries and artists are being influenced by Berlin's complex presence.
One of the reasons that I'm in Berlin, and which is intriguing for me, is that the history is here. It's not necessarily in these bricks and mortar. It's somehow in this atmosphere. One of the great things with Berlin is it takes time to do things. Berlin is slow enough for art to happen.
Art in Berlin, a film about ghosts of the past with a view to the future, on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House. It is at 10:42 in Istanbul, 8:42 here in London. Now, time for a quick peek at tonight's edition of our weekly food show, The Menu. This week, we're treating our sweet tooth in Turkey with a report on Turkish delights. The small, spongy cubes that taste like sugar are sold up and down the tourist streets in Istanbul. I'm lucky, Tyler, there wasn't any Turkish pronunciation in there.
No, me too.
But after more than 100 years, one of the oldest shops in Istanbul, Hafiz Mustafa, has come up with a new take on Turkish delight. Monocle's Ashley Cleek visited the shop in Istanbul.
1864, he established here, that man.
Zia points to a portrait of Hafiz Mustafa.
And he established for 149 years ago.
He's wearing a Turkish fez, and a thick black mustache covers any trace of a smile. Zia loves his job. He's been working at this sweet shop for 10 years. He runs the floor, and it's a small floor. Only about 50 square meters. The tiny shop is popular with tourists and locals.
Make it six.
Just lemon.
It's the second oldest sweet shop in Istanbul. The walls are covered with traditional blue and white ceramic tiles. Like in a mosque, Zia says.
Tile, yeah, a kind of tile. Ottoman tile.
A mosque that worships sweets. Specifically, Turkish Delight. The first time I heard about Turkish Delight was in the BBC miniseries based on C.S. Lewis's The Chronicles of Narnia. In the books and the miniseries, a little boy named Edmund is given Turkish Delight by the White Witch.
You must bring them to me.
All right, I'll try.
Because if you brought them to me, I should give you more Turkish Delight.
Oh, give it to me now.
Years later, in college, I finally tried Turkish Delight. And honestly, it was horrible. It was like a hard gumdrop, with tasteless powdered sugar all over. Then I came to Istanbul.
Firstly, this place established on Turkish Delights. Turkish Delights makes from starch sugar and water. We are cooking in a big cauldrons, and around 12 hours. And after that, pull out on the marble into the forms, and we cut into small pieces like that.
At first, Hafez Mustafa just sold Turkish Delight, plain, standard sugar version. Then they expanded. This is not your duty-free, cardboard-tasting Turkish Delight.
Yeah, you can see from here, mint, cinnamon, lemon, pomegranate, apple, orange, plain, there is nothing inside. And after that, we have strawberry there, double-roasted pistachio, double-roasted hazelnut, and orange and hazelnut, some walnut, a lot of. I didn't count, but yeah, I think more than around 250. We can make more, but we have small place.
They use all natural ingredients. You can see whole hazelnuts bulging out of the small squares. Bits of orange and lemon poke out of the fruity pieces.
And after that, we started to sell like this.
And this is their signature Turkish delight, pomegranate and pistachio.
Pomegranate and pistachio, that one. I love that. That's my best. Look at me.
Imagine a long rectangular taffy dusted with tiny green pieces of pistachio. The end is cut off, and inside you see bright red pomegranate mixed with more pistachios.
You know, I told you before, we called them, we are putting starch, sugar, water, and pomegranate juices. And after that, boiled around 12 hours, and after they put out on the marble into the forms, when it gets nearly cold, we on site like this powder pistachio, and they get like this.
It's by far the most popular Turkish delight they sell, and totally unlike what's sold in other sweet shops.
No, nobody don't know these things.
Really?
Yeah, we can't give. Because we are producing this one.
Other stores have tried to copy Hafez Mustafa, but the recipe is secret. Zia points down to his belly.
Yeah, if you eat enough, you're healthy. But if you eat more than enough, not healthy.
For today, he says, he's eaten just enough.
And that was Ashley Cleek there reporting from Istanbul for the menu. And I've got to be honest, I've never been a big fan of Turkish delights.
Well, that's exactly why we are sending you to Istanbul in a couple of weeks to produce there, because everyone says that you want to taste some of Turkish delights.
I would love to taste some Turkish delights.
We'll sort that out. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I have a very, very special treat. And as this is radio, sometimes, you know, there's been a discussion as to whether or not we should put some type of webcam into the studio here, because if you could see Phil Hahn, he actually looks like...
Don't say Kim Jong-un.
No, I'm not going to say Kim Jong-un. I'm going to say that you look like one of those many, many thousands of performers who constitute all of these K-pop groups, boys and girls, who all have sometimes, you know, especially this time of the year when they're making their videos, that they all have sort of the most remarkable tans. And anyway, this is something for you this morning at approaching 8:48. This is Dolls by Nine Muses. And that was the Nine Muses with Dolls. We're having a conversation there about plastic surgery. There is this certain type of nose, though. If you're in a K-pop group, you don't have it, Phil.
And can I just say for the record, the tan is real?
The tan is real, but I was actually wondering, have you had the double eye lift?
No, I haven't.
You haven't?
This is all real. This is all Phil Hahn.
Really?
Yeah, it's all Phil Hahn. 100%.
Rather clocked, 24 hours a day. That is absolutely brilliant. We've been joined in studio as well by David Pleasant, who I think it's all David Pleasant all the time as well. we're going to do the Italian Papers.
Yeah, well, hello.
Hello.
Well, I thought we'd kind of do a whistle-stop tour from Milan to Rome via Turin. Firstly, as it's the first time we've done an Italian paper review on Monocle 24, I thought I'd kind of build a picture of the newspaper scene. The paper that you read in Italy is still very important, although Italians read less broadsheets than their European counterparts when they do read them.
And when you say that, you know, when you're sitting on the tram in Milan, what you're seen to be reading?
It's political allegiance, it's city allegiance, it's more important. I don't think there's another kind of country in Europe that it matters more what's seen under your arm, you know, when you're off to work. So if we kind of run through La Repubblica, a Roman title, it was quite a recent publication. So it started in the 70s. So it still has this kind of freshness about it. Well, according to the kind of intelligentsia, they see it as something kind of reformist and left-leaning. And it has that kind of feeling about it, although it's just as kind of, now it's become just as bogged in the traditionalist kind of nature of the whole scene as all the others. Then we've got the Corriere, which is a Milan paper, centre-right, more traditional, more business-focused. Then if we kind of go to the Il Sole 24, the business daily, that's perhaps the most centrist of them all. And then there's obviously the regional city papers, which are immensely important. So, for instance, you'll be able to get a Sardinian paper in Trieste or a Turin paper in Sicily. So people will still always stick to their city newspaper. So just for background. So if we go to some of today's news, La Repubblica is leading with this scandal of Berlusconi, basically one of the president's wise men that he's appointed to sort out the problem of the presidential crisis, has been caught on radio criticizing Berlusconi quite harshly, basically calling him an old fool and saying that he it's time he retired, and also that he's just kind of in this latest electoral problem just to kind of clear his name. So, I mean, that's pretty serious stuff, pretty serious allegations. Now Berlusconi's digging his heels in and saying that the whole system of these wise men that have been appointed by the president is a farce. So that's
Do we know what outlet that was on? Was he on Radio 24? Was he on Rai?
It was on Radio 24,
which is the audio broadcast arm of the newspaper you just referenced.
Exactly. So it seems that there's real kind of battle going on as always. The interesting thing is that it is one of the president's men who's been caught doing this. So it's a bit of a scandal for the president as well, who's trying to, as hard as possible, to form a government and also hand over to the next president, because there's no clear idea about who's going to be taking over from Napolitano.
I guess what I'm just wondering is, everyone knows the reputation that Berlusconi has, you know, not only Italians, but everyone in the world essentially knows, you know, that he's a bit of a joker. He's got quite a reputation. So why is it such a big deal then that one of these, I guess, wise men have said publicly, I guess, what everyone thinks and everyone talks openly all the time?
Well, I think it's a question of kind of honor and standards. There's still this perception, rightly so, perhaps, that the officials should have some decorum and respect. So they try and avoid this kind of fisticuffs mentality that is so famous abroad in terms of kind of fighting and squabbling in parliament. So this is kind of like the antithesis of that, with a radio interview with one of these so-called wise men deploring Berlusconi and his antics. So it's not good news for the Italian political scene, and that's what La Repubblica is leading on.
Mm. Do we want to go to Turin, to La Stampa next?
Yeah, let's go to the Stampa. The Stampa's leading on Grillo and his secret meeting. Today he's announced...
Well, secret that it's in the paper.
Exactly. It's so secret. Exactly. He sent an email to all his elected parliamentarians of the Movimento 5 Stelle on Wednesday evening, saying that they are to meet at a secret location outside of Rome. They've managed to keep the location secret, at least, although there's some speculation that it's in the Abruzzo region. What's quite funny is that is the language that he's using to talk about kind of political meetings and so on. He's really kind of deploying these new kind of terms. Like he's saying, I just want to give you a couple of hugs, that's all. Just encouragement.
Sounds hot. Oh,
yeah. Well, I think he's...
Say in Italian.
Vi darò due carezze. Solo questo. So he's just trying to...
Is this new touchy-feely management language in Italy?
I think so. And I think it's interesting how it's being reported on. This is really new stuff for politics and in Italy. And I think it can only be complimented, really. So that's what La Stampa and actually Corriere della Sera are touching on today.
And David, just 20 seconds. What's Il Giornale leading on?
Well, typically, Giornale is criticising La Repubblica, its great rival. And we've got to remember, Il Giornale is part of the Mediaset, Berlusconi's empire. So they are claiming that Saviano, the famous writer and film director, and Repubblica's editor are facing big allegations of defamation of a judge. That's not really being validated by other sources. It seems to be Il Giornale's lead. And also that they seem to be very keen on a quote by a centre-left politician, Nikki Vendola, the rich must go to hell, it says. So, I mean, they seem to be completely out of touch with what the rest of the papers are saying.
David Pleasant, as ever, thank you very much for that full briefing on the print media scene in Italy, and also for that review as well. That is all the time we have for today's program. It's been ably produced by Alad John. Our researchers, Alexander de Kramer and Amelia Jen, and our studio manager today was Alex Funnel. Oh, no, I thought that was your... I wanted to be generous. I wanted to give you the next line of the script.
Very kind. Well, next after the news, Hugo MacDonald will be bringing you the latest edition of Section D.
I'll take the next line. The briefing is at midday with Steve Bloomfield. Midori House is going to be back at the same time on Monday. I'm also here with The Stack at 10 a.m. London time tomorrow. But for me, Tyler Brûlé.
And 100% Phil Hahn.
Have a very good weekend. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.